That's a little bit of the song Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads off their 1980 masterpiece, Remain in Light. Jim, both of us are huge fans of Talking Heads since their debut record in 1977, when the group burst out of the New York punk scene with a sound pretty much all its own at that time.
A sound and a look, Greg. The core of the band was always singer David Byrne, drummer Chris France, bassist Tina Weymouth, and keyboardist and guitarist Jerry Harrison. Talking Heads was this incredible sonic blend of different elements that would eventually be called new wave, or art pop, or funk, post-punk, you name it. They were all of those things. Among the group's leather-clad contemporaries at CBGB, like the Ramones, the Dead Boys, or the more pop-oriented Blondie, Talking Heads didn't sound like anybody else. And with their khakis and their collared Izod shirts, they didn't look like anybody else either.
Yes, absolutely, Jim. And they went on to have a huge musical career, making 8 albums from 1977 through 1988 and releasing one of the most iconic concert films ever made, Stop Making Sense. Now, each of the 4 members went on to a degree of individual success, and Tina Weymouth and Chris France found a second creative life with their group Tom Tom Club.
This week, we're excited to talk with the drummer of Talking Heads and the person whose idea it was to get the band together in the first place, Chris France. Chris recently released a memoir, Remain in Love, which tells the story of his life in Talking Heads and his personal and professional partnership with Heads and Tom Tom Club bassist Tina Weymouth, France's spouse since 1977. It's an inspiring love story. Chris, welcome to Sound Opinions, and thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Congratulations on this book. It is written in very plain-spoken language, fun to read. It's as if we were sitting on a couch with you, and you're telling us these fascinating tales of you making music. I have got to ask, the accounts of those early tours, and then later ones that we all saw, you know, on film and everywhere else, are so detailed and vivid, remembering the places, the backstage locales and the faces, and then even giving us the set list. Were you keeping a journal this whole time?
You know, I'm still kicking myself that I didn't keep a journal. In fact, I even went out and bought a couple of journals thinking that I should be keeping a journal, and I never got it together. But fortunately for me, Tina kept date books, not really a journal, but like date books like you buy at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. For example, The one for 1977 has King Tut on the cover. Remember him?
And, it was a big deal, yeah.
Tina was our road manager at the time, and so she would write the name of the venue, how many tickets were sold, how many encores we received, and whether or not we liked the promoter. And sometimes she would say, great show, 3 encores, got paid, made an additional percentage. And other times she would say, show was not great, never come back here again. but most of them were very positive. Reading Tina's date books helped trigger memories of various events. So she kept very accurate records of where we were and when. That's how I was able to do that.
Tina collected the money too, right? She's the road manager. She was the one that had to go in there and get the money at the end of the gig, right? And, you know, you'd read the stories about, you know, the black musicians on the Chitlin circuit. They had to go in there sometimes armed, you know, because the promoter inevitably would be armed and denying them the money. So in order to get the money, they had to, you know, bring some heat to the negotiation. Did you guys ever have any trouble when you were just starting out getting paid?
There were a couple of times that we didn't get paid properly, But fortunately, they were very few, because nobody wanted to get in trouble with Tina. Yeah. She did. I write about it in the book. More than once, she sat down at the desk with the promoter at the end of the night, and he would have a pistol there as they counted out the cash. In Nashville, the guy counted out the cash, and he overcounted. He gave Tina too much. So she counted it, and she said, "I'm sorry, sir, you've given me too much." And he couldn't believe it. He invited us back very soon because
an honest band.
Yeah, it's that. I think that was pretty rare in his experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. You know, the love of making music in this group comes through. I gather it's one reason. Remain in Love is the title. Tina Weymouth, your wife of how many years now?
We recently celebrated our 43rd anniversary. Yeah,
crazy. That is so wonderful. Congratulations. 43 years loving music, loving your wife, obviously. Not always loving what I'm going to call the romantic myth, that there's a genius in a band, right? That it's not a band, that it's not a collaboration between four people, and sometimes five when the producers were significant, right? And the press did that to David Byrne, often ignoring that everybody was writing, everybody was essential to the band. It's you started the band.
Yes, I did. I approached David and said, "How would you like to start a band?" And I brought Tina in. I also brought Jerry Harrison in. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, in Talking Heads, there were four geniuses.
What drew you to David initially? Because he really owns up to the fact that he was pretty eccentric from the start. He was a difficult character.
He was very awkward socially. But when I played some music with him, I really connected. And he was still is a great rhythm guitarist, which I love, a good rhythm guitar. There was no denying that he had a presence that other people didn't have. He had a certain degree of charisma, but in a way it was kind of like, not exactly charisma, it was almost a reverse charisma that he had in the early days. A train wreck, you might say, because he was so awkward and uncomfortable and sweating and as he performed that I think some people thought he was having a nervous breakdown right on stage. Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean by a train wreck. Later, we all became more sophisticated and more polished. But in the early days, we were a challenging band, I mean, aesthetically.
I love the fact in the book that you say that on occasion, since it was the only clean laundry in the loft you and Tina and David shared, David would actually be on stage in some of your Izod polo shirts that Mom had given you for Christmas.
Yeah, David would often wear my shirts just because his own, when you're playing at CBGB's, especially in the summer, you go through shirts really quickly. And I was happy to lend David my shirts. He looked good in them.
Part of the awkwardness that you were talking about was the fact that, you know, here you were this alleged punk band and you didn't look like punks. You were wearing these kind of preppy clothes. And I think a lot of people right away, you stood out as being different. In reading the book, Chris, I get a sense it was just a matter of, hey, these are the clothes we wear. I mean, we're not looking to make a fashion statement, which in itself was a statement. I mean, did you think it through that much, or was it just a matter of like, hey, here's the nearest shirt I can grab, let's put this on?
We did think it through. Before we ever did a single show, we said, we're not going to dress like the New York Dolls or the Rolling Stones. We're not going to have costumes. We're going to have everyman clothes, like a guy who works at the drugstore would wear, or in Tina's case, a woman who sells shoes would wear. We're going to, you know, be normal looking, and that's going to be our shtick. And it really worked, because all the other bands were dressing up in costumes, and if not the black leather jackets, they were wearing like satin shirts and high-heeled snakeskin boots and things. Mm-hmm. And we were just dressed like some kids from the suburbs, you know. Mm-hmm. And it made a big impression. Some people didn't get it. I remember Johnny Thunders coming up to me after our first performance and saying, "Are you guys a feminist band?"
Yeah, and, I love that.
I said to him, "Yes, as a matter of fact, we are."
Mommy, Daddy, come and look at me now. I'm a big man in a great big town. Years ago, who would be, believe it's true. Goes to show what a little faith can do. I was complaining, I was down in the dumps. I felt so strong, I thought you pulled me up. Pulled me up, 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 up.
Also key, I think, and you really highlight this, was the love from the beginning of black music. Black grooves, yeah. Motown grooves, funk grooves. And of course, a lot of that comes from you. A lot of it comes from Tina, but she approaches it from the world of classical music and plays it in her own completely unique way. But I wonder, you talk about your Army brat upbringing. Born in Kentucky, travel around a lot. Dad was a general eventually. I wonder how you came to be such a lover of black music.
First of all, the way it sounds. I love the way it sounds, but I went for a couple of years to school in Virginia, Episcopalian boarding school for boys. And I was a music lover, and I had like my Beatles records, my Stones records, my Birds records. And one of the guys in my dormitory said, "Oh man, you can't listen to that." He said, "You got to listen to soul. I'm going to get you James Brown live at the Apollo." And he went and got it, and he put it on my little record player in my room. You know, the first James Brown Live at the Apollo album. And I thought, oh man, I see what you're talking about. This is really something.
And believe me, I'm a crazy boy. And believe me, I'm a crazy boy.
And then he also introduced me to Stax, which I was familiar with Motown because that was all over the airwaves, but where I lived. But Stax, not so much. And so Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Booker T and the MGs, all that was a real turn on for me. But at the same time, Bob Dylan came out and the Velvet Underground came out right at that same time. And I was an appreciator of all kinds of music. But as a drummer, I found soul music, you might say, the most compelling because it was funky and you could dance to it. You could really dance to it.
Yeah, that element was not overly present in the scene that you came up in. You know, the groove.
Right.
You guys had that. The other bands really didn't. I mean, the Ramones were a great band, but they were certainly not a groove funky band. You had that influence of the funk, but it seemed very contemporary the way you guys weaved it in there. And was that just kind of, I mean, obviously the influence was there for you, but did everybody share in that right from the get-go? How did that sort of evolve sound-wise? Were you writing songs with that sort of danceable groove right away?
We were attempting to write songs with a danceable groove right away. Yeah, and we didn't always succeed, but that was our goal. Mm-hmm. And our other goal was to write songs that were maybe not exactly predictable for a rock group. For example, "Don't Worry About the Government," that song. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine any other band at that time playing that song.
Pretty radical. And The songwriting, I think you did a nice job in the book, Chris, of sort of talking about the collaborative aspects of that. And, you know, I scanned the credits on those early records, and it doesn't appear that you guys really got the credit you deserved. Did that cause any tension? I imagine it did, but was it some bands break up over that kind of stuff? You guys held it together. How did you manage?
We could have quit the band over that, but then there wouldn't have been any talking heads. So we knew that even from the very early days, we knew that talking heads had some unique chemistry going on that other bands didn't have, and we it was important to us. We shared a lot of aesthetic ideas. We had similar tastes in what we were hoping to accomplish. And Tina and I learned, and Jerry also learned very early on that, you know, David is just wired in a different way than other people, than you and me. It's difficult for him to understand where he ends and other people begin. So if he's collaborating with you on a song, everything goes great. You know, there's give and take. You have an idea. He says, oh, that's good. And he has an idea and you say, oh yeah, man, that's great. And it all comes together. And then David says, oh, look at this wonderful song I've written. And he kind of forgets that other people were there too. And so we learned early on that this is what we're dealing with. And if we want to keep the band going and the music flowing and the whole gestalt of the thing, we're going to have to learn to live with this. And we did. It's not like we didn't call him out on it from time to time. Like, David, you seem to have forgotten that I wrote those lyrics. He would say, oh, we'll change it on the second pressing.
Wow.
It's sad to read those parts of the book. And you don't do it in a, I'm going to, you know, stab him in the back way. I mean, it just seems, at one point you suggest that David was somewhere on the spectrum. You know, as you just said now, you know, difficult to deal with, saw things his own way. But it just, it had to have taken a toll on you and Tina and Jerry.
Well, it was a challenge, but one thing I'm trying to convey in this book is, you know, when people have written about Talking Heads in the past, they often accentuate the conflicts that we had. Every band has conflicts, but it gets kind of boring to hear about those conflicts over and over again. With this book, I was trying to convey that despite some conflicts, we had wonderful times, very exciting times, and not just once or twice, but for years. And we worked really hard, and we did great work together. And so I want people to know that Talking Heads was a shared experience, and that it was an excellent experience. I've said it before, if I had to do it all over again, I would, because that's how good it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the great irony when you hear about how the Ramones were at each other's throats for so long, or some of the conflicts that were part of Talking Heads, or, you know, is that I remember being a kid when Talking Heads 77 came out, WPIX, New York's new wave radio station, and then comes Tina. Bump, bump, bump. I was coming from my first concert at Madison Square Garden, Jethro Tull. All right. Nothing Jethro Tull did that night made me think I could do that. And then I hear Psycho Killer. And it's like, hey, maybe I could do that in my basement with those drums my stepdad gave me.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep cause my bed's on fire.
Wow. You know, the great message was, Patty said it, Patty Smith, this is the era where everybody creates. Do it. do something yourself. You know, and that's the joy, I think, that comes across in Remain in Love. You know, you got something to say. What's stopping you? Whether it's going to be the visual art you and Tina were always doing, or making the music, or you know, films later, or the audacity for the drummer and the bassist to start a band called Tom Tom Club.
Yeah, that turned out pretty well.
I'd say more hits than David ever had as a solo act.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not a contest, you know. Some people try to make it into a contest, but I was just happy that we had the success we had. I wish David had had the same amount of success with his... he's doing well now on Broadway, very well, playing Talking Head songs.
Mm-hmm. You know. Even then, there's an anecdote in the book that Seymour Stein, the guy who signed you to Sire Records, Talking Heads... Uh-huh. Was skeptical about you and Tina doing a solo record. He said, "Oh, I already signed David and Jerry to solo deals. I don't need another band," was the anecdote.
Yeah.
And yet you had the first big major hit of anybody in the band.
Yes.
There must have been a little feeling of satisfaction when that happened.
It was extremely gratifying and also a pleasant surprise as much for Tina and I as it was for everybody else. But that song was mega, Genius of Love. Mm-hmm. And before it, Wordy Rapping Hood. I mean, you know, talk about crossover. We crossed over, baby.
It was inspiring to hear that in discos and in black clubs and in CBGB or the Ritz at that period in New York.
Yeah, or Danceteria or the Mud Club. Yeah.
When we come back, more of our conversation with Talking Heads drummer Chris France. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis. And this week, we're talking to Chris France, the drummer of Talking Heads. Chris recently released his new book, Remain in Love, about his life and experience in music. Now, let's get back to our conversation.
I want to actually ask you about something I read Tina said. It's got to be 20 years ago. She had a vision. You know, somebody asked her, an interviewer asked her, and I couldn't find the quote to exactly give it to you, but I wanted to see your thoughts on it. Somebody asked her about what it was like, you know, to work with David Byrne and to work with Brian Eno. And she said, you know, I always have this vision of Byrne, Eno, and Bowie someday in their retirement when they're 80 years old, sitting on a porch, and they're the only three people who can talk to each other, these isolated geniuses who never connected with the rest of humanity. And of course, Bowie is gone, and that's sad. But I wonder, to what extent did you see that? Because Eno starts out great, and he winds up being a real pain in the neck.
Well, I still have enormous respect for Brian, and he was a great producer for us. He was perfect, but this is often the case, unfortunately. When things are going well, the business gets all messed up. And as great as he was as a producer and as a collaborator, he was also a pain in the neck when it came to business. He always was, I think the Yiddish call it a schnurrer. Somebody, mm-hmm. you lend them $5 and they say, oh, could you lend me another $5? You know, it's like, before we knew it, Brian was demanding to be flown on the Concorde. Then he went back and forth across the Atlantic a lot. And he expected us to pay for him to fly on the Concorde. I never flew on the Concorde. I wish I had, but, you know, I thought it was too expensive. And I write about it in the book. U2 had the same problem. Paul McGinnis, the manager of U2. I ran into him one night. I think it was a Kirsty MacColl show at Tramps in New York. And I said, oh, Paul, how you doing? Because we knew Paul and the band. And how's the new U2 album? And he said, oh, it's nothing but problems. I said, oh, really? How come? He says, Brian Eno. He keeps making more and more demands. And then he demanded to mix the record, and we listened to it, and the mixes weren't any good. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, we're going to do what we always do. We're going to call Steve Lillywhite. And, you know, that sort of gives you an idea of the magnitude of these kind of petty business problems.
Nonetheless, a handful of excellent albums with Eno.
Yes. I mean, fantastic.
Yeah. You give a great anecdote about how you sort of came to recontextualize Al Green's Take Me to the River in the Talking Heads voice. What, you know, you made it your song. I mean, obviously it's Al Green's classic, but it's also became one of your signature songs. Eno played a role in that. Could you talk a little bit about how that came together with Eno's input?
That was on More Songs About Buildings and Food, the recording session at Compass Point in the Bahamas. And it was our second album, our first time with Brian as producer. And we had all the songs very well rehearsed. We'd been performing them live on tour, and we were ready to go. All Brian had to really do was set up the mics and press record. But he made a few suggestions, and one of the suggestions was regarding Take Me to the River. He said, we had been playing it at the tempo that Al Green plays it, or maybe even a little faster. And Al Green recorded the song at a pretty high tempo. And we had been doing that, playing it that way. And Brian said, what if we slow it down? What if you play it as slow as possible without losing the groove? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay. Because, you know, it's a challenge to play a groove slowly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's something that takes a good deal of finesse and experience. But we managed to do it. And it did sound better. It was really cool. Gave the song much more space, so these little musical events could happen in those spaces. It was our first top 40 hit.
Yeah, and there were some little effects too on your drum sound too as well, right?
Yes, he Brian had a little portable like briefcase synthesizer, but he would treat what he calls treat the sounds. So he would run like my snare drum, for example, through this little synthesizer and alter the sound, put effects on it, and it really worked very nicely. And he also used delays, you know. We didn't have digital delays then. We had to use, like, other types of delays. But, that Take Me to the River was smoking. Mm-hmm. And the bass line, ooh.
Yeah, we know that bass player.
Yeah.
you and Tina were a great rhythm section, are a great rhythm section. The other thing that was fascinating about that period with Eno, the anecdote in the book about Remain in Light, like possibly not even being made because it seemed, well, you can tell the story, Chris, but I mean, I'm just amazed that this was like, you pulled that album out of nothing. It didn't seem like the Talking Heads were going to be working at that time, right?
Yeah. David and Brian had just finished, well, actually, they hadn't even finished My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. And unbeknownst to the rest of us, we knew nothing about that recording because they took the project out to San Francisco and they worked out there away from all of us in the band. And evidently there had been some kind of dispute. I don't know. I still don't know what it was between David and Brian. And so Brian left, went back to New York, and David finished things up in San Francisco. And the two of them didn't really want to speak to each other. Hmm. And on top of that, David didn't really want to do another record with Talking Heads. He wanted to go in a solo direction. Mm-hmm. So Tina had a good idea. She called up Brian and she said, "Hey, Brian, Chris and Jerry and I are having a jam session over here at our place. Why don't you come over and join us?" And Brian said, "Oh, but you know I don't play any instruments." And Tina said, "That's okay. We're not going to judge your musical talent. Just come on over and jam with us." And he said, "Okay." And he came over, and we gave him a keyboard, and we were having a good time playing together. And then she got on the phone and said, "I'm going to call David." And she called David and said, "David, Chris and Jerry and I are having this great jam session with Brian Eno. Why don't you come over and join us?" And David, I guess, thought about it for a minute or two and said, "Okay, I'll be right over." And within the hour, he was there with his guitar. And we started the groundwork for what became Remain in Light at that point. And, you know, Remain in Light was entirely based on improvisations that we did in the studio and then refined it into different parts, different song sections. Yeah. And it was a new way of making a record for us. Mm-hmm. And it turned out pretty well.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
For sure. Turned out really well, I'd say.
Take a look at these hands. The hand speaks. The hand never got an end there. Well, I'm a tumbler. Born under punches.
Of course, the band gets bigger after that. People are added on stage. The production. It becomes a stage show. But in some ways, Chris, as I was reading the book, it seemed as though, as if, you know, there's two acts in Talking Heads, everything up to Remain in Light, and including Remain in Light, and then everything else was sort of after. You never knew what was going to happen next, and it was sort of on David's whims, and you and Tina were devoted to the group and wanted and made sacrifices to keep it going. Jerry had some struggles and then had to clean up. You know, but do you see it as that way? After that, it becomes less of a band and more subject to David's whims, not in terms of collaboration, but just in what are we going to create?
Well, at a certain point, it kind of became the David Byrne show. And that was fine with David.
mm-hmm.
But like I said, even on those later albums, and especially on our last album, Naked, which we recorded in Paris, the band was fully present and fully operational and fully like part of that chemistry. So I think I put it this way in my book. People thought that David Byrne was the goose that laid the golden egg. But in fact, he was the golden egg, and Talking Heads was the goose.
We've been talking to Chris France, author of Remain in Love, Talking Heads, Tom Tom Club, Tina. It's been a great pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much for coming on Sound Opinions.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure for me, too. Stay healthy and enjoy yourself.
That wraps up our conversation with Chris France, and now we want to hear from you, our listeners. What's your favorite Talking Heads song? Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message with your answer and tell us why. Coming up, Jim and I share some of our favorite songs from the catalogs of Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My still socially distanced partner is Greg Kot. And this week we are discussing all things Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. Earlier in the show, we interviewed the drummer for those two groups, Chris France, and we covered a lot of the great music from both bands. But Greg, there is much more to discuss. We've only scratched the surface. We're going to put our two cents in now. Let's take a couple minutes and share some of our favorite tracks from Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. Why don't you lead us off, Mr. Kot?
Thanks, Jim. I wanted to highlight the fact that Talking Heads was so adventurous and so innovative in the way they started incorporating dance rhythms into their music. Punk was not noted as a particularly dance-focused music. In fact, in some respects, people saw rock and punk as sort of an antidote to the rising funk and disco movements, and I thought that was always wrong. And Talking Heads were one of those bands that said, no, we're not anti-disco or club music at all. In fact, we embrace those styles of music, and we want to make them part of our own thing. And I think where they really started to explore that was in their 1979 album, Fear of Music, their third studio album. The lead-off track on that album was a real clarion call for what they would become, E-Zimbra. That song was based on the nonsense words of a German-born Dada poet named Hugo Ball, who died in 1927. He gets a co-writing credit on this particular song. David Byrne was increasingly fascinated with the idea of words serving more of a percussive function rather than a sense of function. In other words, stop making sense, right? It's all about the body music. Who needs words? Words can be a drum. They can be fun. They can be rubbery and malleable. They can be meaningless. Free your mind and your butt will follow, as Parliament Funkadelic was saying during this era. The album in which they begin to more overtly explore that vibe is right here, and it begins with that track. E-Zimbra not only combines these nonsense words, but overlays them in a rhythmic pattern over music that is definitely influenced by West African highlife music. There's West African and Brazilian percussion on this particular song. The band was starting to incorporate outside musicians into their work. The song's all about forward motion with those guitars playing those chicken scratch rhythm lines over the top of this matrix of percussion. And the interplay between Burns rhythm guitar and Tina Weymouth's swooping bass is really key to the song. And the keyboards that Jerry Harrison is playing kind of give it almost like a sci-fi carnival ride feel. So the song is joyous, it's celebratory, but it's also strange and exotic. The Talking Heads are starting to form the basis of what would become their next album, the breakthrough Remain in Light. If you want to know where Remain in Light started, start with this song, E-Zimbra from Talking Heads on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
You know, Greg, Ezimbra, a fantastic track, and you mentioned the African and Brazilian percussion. I think one of Chris France's strengths as a drummer is he played very simply, or always sounded as if he was playing simply, because he held down the groove, but he left space. He left space for, in that song, Jerry Harrison's keyboard, or always his wife, Tina Weymouth, on bass, and percussion. And I love a Tom Tom Club track from later in their career. We talked a lot about that incredible first album that it established that the hit makers in the band were actually Chris and Tina, you know, before Byrne ever had a solo hit. In 1991, Tom Tom Club puts out Dark Sneak Love Action. And there's a fantastic cover of one of my favorite songs, the hot chocolate hit, You Sexy Thing. I guess in some ways, that 1975 song, originally by Errol Brown, was the lead singer of Hot Chocolate. It hasn't, you know, aged very well, You Sexy Thing. You're talking about a woman there, Errol. But when Tom Tom Club covered it, again, 91, you know, having Tina sing in that super laid-back, cool, distanced way about, I believe in miracles, You Sexy Thing. There's something incredibly powerful in her very understated, breathy vocal. Of course, it's got one of the greatest guitar riffs of all time. I think you paid tribute to that guitar hook at one point on the show. And it's got this bubbly, tropical groove, because they sure did love recording in Jamaica, Tom Tom Club, one of their favorite getaways, Chris and Tina. And that seeps in, and again, leaves room for percussion. It's a great, great cover that brings something new. And if you'd never heard the song, you were going to love it instantly. If you had heard the song, you were going to be rewarded by hearing it through these new lenses. I just love this cover. You Sexy Thing by Tom Tom Club from 1991. Sexy Thing. I'm not talking to you, Greg, but Tom Tom Club, you got to love that. Isn't that a great cover?
I love it. I love Hot Chocolate's version, and I love the fact that Tom Tom Club especially embraced that style of music and consistently drew upon it in their career. As did Talking Heads. I think I'm going to continue this thread where Talking Heads, the various members, individually and collectively, were pursuing this vision of club music and dance music and incorporating funk into what they were doing. And for many fans, they came to know the band from that movie we referenced earlier, the Stop Making Sense movie that Jonathan Demme recorded in 1983 and then was released in 1984 and took the band to a new level of fame. And one of the reasons was, I mean, as we well knew from showing this movie a couple of times on Sound Opinions movie nights here in Chicago, the audience couldn't sit still during the movie, let alone during the concert. I mean, people were in the aisles dancing during the movie, and you can see why. There's something joyous about the music that the Heads were making at this point in their career, beginning with Ezimbra and sort of moving through that Remain in Light era and into Speaking in Tongues, the studio album that they were releasing just around the time that this movie was being filmed. So you're hearing this idea of groove as paramount in the song that I'm going to play. It's Slippery People, and it's the moment in the film where the music starts to catch fire. You begin with this kind of stripped-down opening with just Byrne on the stage, and he's joined one by one by the band members, and then the full band is starting to array around him, and the groove really starts to light up, and people start getting out of their seats, and they're dancing, and the band is dancing, and you cannot escape the infectious energy. Now, in this song, Slippery People, on the concert version, the Stop Making Sense version, blows away the studio version is because of that power of that band and those dancers and the energy coming from the audience. And what Byrne was referencing in the song when he, you know, Slippery People, what is that? He was talking about the worshipers in Southern sanctified churches who, when they were filled with the Holy Spirit, they'd start writhing and undulating while speaking in tongues, and they were possessed by the Spirit. They were all body, and they were just abandoning sense, stop making sense. It was more about this physical response, emotional, visceral response to spirituality. And there's biblical allusions in the lyrics, and there's a call and response style in the vocals that evokes gospel music. But most of all, there is that driving groove in the song. The Franz Weymouth rhythm section abetted by Steve Scales on hand percussion. And man, if you can't dance to this, you know, you probably don't have feet. It's Slippery People from Talking Heads, their 1984 Stop Making Sense live album.
Slippery People by Talking Heads. That's a good one, Greg. You do love the dance music, the grooves, always. You know, there's so many Heads songs I could have played. Life During Wartime and Don't Worry About the Government. Boy, there are two that resonate now. But we spent a lot of time on Talking Heads 77. I want to focus on a tune from what I considered to be the last great Talking Heads album, Little Creatures, sixth in their catalog. There were records that followed, but the band, you can sense, was already pulling apart. Byrne was reluctant to collaborate with anyone anymore, really, especially the members of the Heads. But I want to focus on a song that's a rarity in the catalog. Now, obviously, it was a point with Chris France that he and Tina Weymouth and Jerry Harrison did not often get the songwriting credit they felt they deserved. You know, Byrne claimed the lion's share of the songwriting credits. But The Lady Don't Mind from Little Creatures is credited to the entire band, all four of them. And it's a beautiful laid-back groove, again, where Franz is leaving a lot of room for other things to happen. An understated melody and a drama in Byrne's vocals about this mysterious woman he's singing about, and those wonderful woodblocks, you know, that kind of punctuate the song that become almost a key hook. If Chris Franz wasn't the tasteful drummer he was, right up there with a Ringo Starr or a Charlie Watts in terms of always playing what the song required, no more, and leaving room for others, you know, it wouldn't be as effective. And then when everything kicks in midway through the tune, it takes it to a new, higher level. I've always been very fond of Little Creatures. I think it's underrated in Talking Heads canon. And also, I think it includes a line that Byrne sings, I don't know who wrote it, you know, about, I like this curious feeling. Well, you know, if there's one line in all of the Talking Heads lyrics that sum up what listening to Talking Heads is about, right? They don't ever feel like anybody else. I like this curious feeling. I know you do, too. This is The Lady Don't Mind by Talking Heads.
She floats by. Come on, I go up and down. I like this curious feeling.
The Lady Don't Mind, one of many favorite Talking Heads songs, Greg. It's been fun to indulge with Chris France and all things Heads and Tom Tom Club. What do we have on the show next week?
Yeah, Jim, great pick to close it off. And next week, we are going to dive into the eternal analog versus digital debate.
You can download the Sound Opinions podcast wherever you get such things. The show was produced by Brendan Banaszak, Alex Claiborne, and Andrew Gill.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages. Hi, guys. This is Sharon. I'm calling from Kent, Ohio. I just want to tell you, I didn't know your podcast existed until this year. So I'm like, holy crap. I got a whole backlog to listen to, which makes me very happy. I love your show. Thanks so much. Bye.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Hey, this is Michael Jafarian in Springfield, Oregon. So songs about helping, and the one that comes to mind for me is Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Got such acclaim. 5 Grammy Awards, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Album of the Year, covered by all kinds of people. Anyhow, with all the acclaim, if we just sort of push that aside and look back at the words of the song, we realize how piercingly beautiful it is.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side.
Paul Simon, a poet and a one-man band. Thanks for the show, guys. Great, great choice of topic.
Like a bridge over troubled water.
This is Bob from Croton. I just heard the Help episode, and I love these theme shows because they make me consult that great music streaming machine in the cloud called my brain to see what I recall that fits the genre. I did it here and realized that there are a couple of iconic songs you left out. It's easy to dismiss these songs as saccharine because of the subject matter, but if you put that aside, I think you find they can get you right in the gut. Songs like You've Got a Friend by Carole King from 1971. I first heard this many years ago at sleepaway camps when I was surrounded by my friends, and it got to me. And Don't Stop Believing, the great song by Journey from 1981, which got new life when it served as the soundtrack to this great show, The Sopranos, final episode many years later. Anyway, those are my picks. They're iconic songs, and I think they should be included. Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going in. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere.
Hi, this is Matthew from Atlanta, formerly from Athens, Georgia. I just listened to your show on Help, and I cannot believe that you did not include REM's Fall on Me. That is the greatest song about help that I could even think of. I know, Jim, you said REM was the band that broke your heart. That's a band that breaks my heart every time I listen to them. And I would love for people to hear Fall on Me. Thank you.
There's a problem with design, bargain buildings, weights and pulleys. Feathers hit the ground before the weight can leave the air. By the
more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.